somebody told you they wanted an exotic dinner tonight, you probably would not suggest a grilled cheese sandwich or barbecue or pretty much anything from McDonald's. Those foods are so familiar to some of us that we may think of them as just food. But if we take a couple of steps back from our own limited perspective, it becomes clear that almost any dish Americans consider exotic is just food somewhere else in the world. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In practice, we've developed a bad habit of labeling food as exotic when we mean foreign or unfamiliar or even weird, the kind of fare we assume only adventurous eaters are excited to sample. And in doing this, we make it really easy to assume there is something inherently different about the cultures and people for whom these foods are regular dietary staples. Daniela Galarza thinks it's time to stop that. She is a staff writer for the food section of the Washington Post, which published her recent essay, Stop Calling Food Exotic. She also writes a newsletter for the Post. Daniela, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
When you hear the word exotic applied to food, what is the subtext that seems to be underlying it?
I've heard it for many years. I've been writing about food for about 10 years and worked in restaurants for about 10 years before that. And I think it's changed a lot for me. I think growing up outside of Chicago, I probably heard it about cuisines which were just generally not American, or like you said in the intro, not grilled cheese, not macaroni and cheese. But I think as I've been exposed more to cultures across the United States, where there's, you know, diasporas from everywhere have landed here, it started to lose its meaning. And I started to, when I hear it now, I'm sort of mystified. I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to think. And I mostly think now, I wonder where that person is from, the person that's using it.
So it tends to be applied to food that comes from places not historically populated by white people. Is that fair?
That's what I think, yeah.
So you note that what is exotic is very much in the eye or the mouth of the beholder. The things that some Americans think of as familiar comfort foods might well be odd or exotic elsewhere in the world. How did we get to this place where we assume that what's familiar to us must be what everybody likes?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And that's one that I wanted to address when I decided to write about this word and its usage in the world. I think it has to do, you know, you have to go all the way back to when the word was invented. It was invented by the Greeks in probably the 15 or the 1600s. And that was a time period when they were conquering a lot of the world. They were taking over a lot of different peoples and cultures and religions and infusing their culture into them. And they invented the word as a way to describe people who were alien or foreign, but also people who they were subjugating and possibly enslaving. And I think that that's an important context when you think about how it's used today.
So in other words, the people in a position to declare something exotic are the people who have the power.
Right.
So you started thinking about this when readers would complain about some of your recipes in the Washington Post. What were the patterns you noticed in how people responded to some of your meal ideas?
Yeah, so I write a recipe newsletter for the Post called Eat Voraciously. It's free for everyone to subscribe. I hope everyone does. It's meant to offer a wide range of dinner ideas for readers. I include one full recipe in each newsletter, along with a number of ways to adapt it for different dietary needs or taste preferences. And just by, I think, the nature of the way I cook and the way I define eating voraciously, I think I eat food from all over the place, and I like to cook food from all over the place, whether I'm familiar with it or not. I think of cooking as a way to get to know other cultures, not just through their cuisines, but through their techniques and through the flavors and spices that they use. And so some of the time when I was writing about something that wasn't, say, a grilled cheese sandwich or a BLT or macaroni and cheese, I would get emails from readers saying, you know, that they couldn't find these ingredients or they couldn't find this spice, they couldn't find that condiment. And I'm really attuned to that. You know, I feel that I sympathize with that greatly. Like, even though the United States has done an incredible job in figuring out the logistics for how to import ingredients from all over the world, in addition to manufacturing so many of them here and making them available at grocery stores. Not everyone can find everything at every grocery store, and there's a lot of regional variation. And certainly people who live in more remote parts of the country, in smaller cities and towns, might not be able to find certain spices and certain condiments or sauces. And I like to offer alternatives. There's always an alternative, I think. And I actually find it fun, you know, when someone says they can't find X, Y, and Z, like I can say, well, you could use this. It would mimic the flavor in this way or that way. You know, if they can't eat something, I suggest something that they might be able to eat that doesn't contain an ingredient that's problematic for them. But when someone, when readers started emailing me describing ingredients that they either couldn't find or that they felt were unappetizing, you know, I think I got some emails with people describing things as disgusting. They used the word exotic alongside that. And that's when I started questioning the word.
And I guess once you noticed it, you realized it was used everywhere. Is it one of those things where suddenly it you realize that it's been all around you and you just hadn't seen it?
Yeah, a little bit. I will say that I think because I write about food and because I'm sort of in this world so much, I've been exposed to it a little bit more. But also, I come from, you know, my father was born in Puerto Rico and my mother was born in Iran, and I've been called exotic myself. And so I think I've also had that experience of questioning why that word is used to describe anything. And when I started doing the research for this piece, I found out that really it's mostly only used to describe food, including plants and animals and fruits from, let's say, non-Anglo-American cultures, and it's used on women, and it's based, that's really the limit to how it's used still today, for the most part. And I found that really interesting too, just, you know, what does that say about why we still use this word and what it means when we use it?
So it's applied to things we objectify, generally speaking.
Yeah. That's what I think, yes.
So I want to talk about this leap between labeling food as exotic and maybe stigmatizing the people who eat and enjoy that food. Why do you think it is such a short leap to racism from the description of a food that is valued by a people to the people themselves?
You know, it might not seem like a short leap, I think, but I think language has a lot of power. And my intent on writing this piece and even doing the research for myself was to dig deeper into the language that we use and why we use it. I think language has a lot of power, and I think words have an impact that we might not intend when we use them. But while intention matters and while we want to expect that everyone has good intentions, I think it's more important to think about the impact that they have on the people or things that they're used on and how that carries forward. So I looked a lot at the history of exotic and why it was invented, why it was used initially, how that usage evolved over time. And then when we use it today, what does it do, given its history? What does it say about the people that it's applied to, the people or things or food that it's applied to? And how do we extrapolate from that? And so I think just in the same way that, you know, I don't know who first said it, you know, you shouldn't yuck on anyone's yum is what I've been told a lot. And I think that's true. You know, I think there are foods I don't like. There are definitely foods I dislike, but I'm not out here saying, oh, I think that's disgusting, or I think people that eat that are terrible, or I think people that, you know, cook those things, there must be something wrong with them, because I think that that implies a judgment, and I don't feel that I'm, you know, that I can judge anyone. They might judge me just as well, you know, to say that things I do are disgusting or off-putting to them. And I think it's more important that we appreciate the differences between each other than point them out.
So I want to talk about this column published by Jean Weingarten last week in your newspaper, The Washington Post. You've described it as casual racism dressed up as satire. Will you just summarize for us what Weingarten said that upset you?
Sure. Weingarten, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Post wrote in the magazine about his food, just all the food that he hates. I didn't know what was happening until it was published, and neither did any of the food section. I just want to clarify, but you know, he had some, I think, a few clever turns of phrase about the some of the foods he didn't like, some specific foods like blue cheese or like California rolls. But he had a section in there about Indian food, and
like all before, Indian food, right?
right, like all Indian food, which initially, you know, absolutely strikes everyone who knows even a tiny bit about Indian food as an enormous statement. It's, I mean, Indian cuisine is far, far older than American cuisine, and it is one of the oldest cuisines in the world, and so it has evolved into incredible regionalism and just such diversity. And to say that you hate every single thing that Indian cooks make is quite a statement. I think that initially struck a lot of people as like, how much does Gene actually know about Indian food before he decided to write this? And but then he describes it as disgusting in a number of different ways, and he points to curry and says curry is one spice. He calls curry one spice. And he also says, and this I think is still in the piece, that if you are like a vulture that can be thrown off a cart of rotting meat, something like that, then you might still like Indian food. He basically calls, he compares Indian food to a rotting carcass. And I think that he had just offended an entire culture in a really flippant and disrespectful way. And I think, like a lot of people, I was offended. I'm not Indian and have, you know, didn't grow up with that cuisine at all, but I could imagine myself in that place. But also, just as a person who writes about food and thinks we should all be appreciating each other's differences, there was a way Weingarten could have said that without offending the entire continent of India and its diaspora.
Yeah, you know, I read the column and I wondered why Gene Weingarten and his editors thought we'd all want to be treated to this list of foods he does not care for. But I will say the piece raises broader questions that you just have alluded to, of how we can talk about foods we don't care for without, boy, I mean, throwing an entire cuisine under the bus without. My guess is that he's only tried these things, these curries he doesn't care for, a couple of times and then decided he doesn't want it.
Right. And hey, I actually, if he's decided he doesn't want it, fine. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think most people care about that. I think that there's, and I guess I would trust that he is a smart and intellectually curious enough person and writer to do some research about it and figure out how to write about that in a way that will convince his reader of his opinion. Because that's what writers are supposed to be doing, right? We're supposed to be putting forth an argument, whether it's our own or someone else's, but in this case, it's his column, and so it's his own personal argument, and then convincing the reader. Otherwise, we're liable to find fault with it. I mean, arguably, as a lot of people found fault with my exotic piece, which is completely fine, but I don't think Gene made a very good argument, and I think that it read to me as performative ignorance that I think is a form of casual racism.
We could spend a whole program talking about how colonialism has shaped food culture all over the world and our perceptions of what is elegant. I'm always interested in French cuisine because it seems like French dishes and fine restaurants, a lot of them began as kind of peasant foods, which is not to throw any shade on foods eaten by people of modest means anywhere. But like, can you talk about how French colonizers changed the cuisines of the countries they invaded, but maybe didn't change their own thinking about food?
Yeah, it's a great case study, you know, and I think I studied French pastry in culinary school, and a lot of people across the globe have studied French cuisine techniques. The French were particularly prolific early on in documenting their techniques and categorizing and in creating a structure around which to learn the culinary arts, and then in colonizing other places and influencing them with their documentation and, you know, genuine pride in their cuisine. And I think that has had just this ripple effect through history, such that even places in Asia or South America that have their own very lengthy, you know, cuisines, very, very well documented in their language, very well categorized in their language. Today, you will still find French culinary schools in those places. And so it continues. And I think it's not a problem, except that a lot of people in those cultures will then start adapting their own food to what is then thought of as like this rule of French cuisine, that French cuisine becomes this end-all be-all, that it is suddenly better than everything else. And I think that's really the problem. But so when, for example, when French colonizers were in Vietnam, you know, they influenced that culture with their bread techniques and you know, certain ways of preparing cured meats. And it resulted in a lot of great foods like banh mi and banh xao, the Vietnamese crepe. But I think on the other side of it, the French will sort of take credit for that, right? And won't credit the Vietnamese with the incredible bounty that they have, that they already had to offer.
I think questions around labeling food exotic and why that could be problematic maybe lie alongside questions about labeling food authentic. I mean, is that also a potentially problematic concept?
You know, I think it can be. I don't think there's anything wrong personally with seeking out authenticity if it matters to you as a person. But I think I think it's sometimes useful as a person who writes about food and loves history. I like to look for the original of a thing. I like to dive into a story and try to figure out like who was the first person that made this and how did they make it and why and who, you know, who first put it into a cookbook and what were they thinking. But I also think all living cuisines are always evolving, just like all living cultures. And so I don't think you can say, you know, for example, a tamale with cheese and chilies can only be made one way. And if you make it a different way, if you suddenly one day use red chilies, it's no longer that thing. It's not authentic. It's terrible. It's garbage. You shouldn't eat it. I think things are always evolving. And I think we should pay respect to the origin of a thing. But I think we can also appreciate when something changes.
Are we just revealing our own kind of provincial nature when we are turned off by, put off by foods that aren't familiar to us? Like, is there something kind of morally or intellectually flawed about people who don't want to try things they haven't tried before?
I guess I wouldn't say that. I don't want to, you know, I think if someone, you know, when they were young, had a bad experience trying something new or visiting a place and isn't comfortable doing it again, you know, I would understand that. But I think if what we want to do is maintain a status quo at all times, if we are staying in the same place or not trying new foods because we're so obsessed with keeping things how they are or going back to a different time, let's say, making something great again, I think that's where it becomes problematic.
There are TV chefs and cookbook authors who have made a lot of money for themselves, putting recipes out into the world that come from cultures they didn't grow up in, cultures they may have looked at and may like very much, but that are not really their own in the classic sense of the word. I'm interested to know how you know, working on the Eat Voraciously newsletter, where you give people a new recipe every night, and it may have been inspired by cuisine in many parts of the world, how you've sort of navigated questions about your own cultural expertise in putting these dishes into people's email boxes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think cultural appropriation is a topic we talk about a lot in food media and in restaurant space as well. And I think it's an important one. There are many smart people who have written on this topic at length. And I think the way I approach it from the perspective of the writing that I do and my newsletter is I try to give credit everywhere it's due. And I try to reference my inspiration or, you know, where my idea came from. So oftentimes I'm adapting a recipe from a cookbook and I want to speak to that cookbook author about why they wrote that recipe and where it came from and if it was their own and if they grew up with it and just get the story behind it. Because I think more than anything else, I want to champion as many different voices as I can on this platform that I have, because it's not just about me. I only know so much and I will only ever know so much. And I, you know, grew up in a very particular circumstances as did we all. And so I'm really here to say, you know, this is what I know and this is what I don't know. And this is what I want to learn more about. And maybe you do too.
It's funny, like how far humility can take you in situations like this, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think I was talking to, I don't know if you've seen the show Ted Lasso.
I love it.
And I read a TV critic's piece on it. And the takeaway I had from that was just that here's a person who, you know, the main character, without giving anything away, is a person who doesn't know a lot about the world he's been thrown into, but he's willing to admit it. And that's why he becomes so endearing, is that it's so rare to see people like that or characters like that on TV. And I think that's why we end up loving him.
Have you been surprised at the responses you received to your column about calling food exotic? I know some people are really in your camp and some people are just appalled with your take on this.
I knew it wouldn't strike everyone. You know, I knew everyone reading it wouldn't automatically agree with me. I didn't expect, there was a lot of hate, I'll say. There were a lot of personal attacks. And I think that comes with the territory. But I don't think that, I think that what troubles me about that is that they didn't really read it or consider it. And my hope is that people who came across the story or come across this program will just think about the language they use and why they use it. You know, I think language is constantly changing. We're constantly adapting to new words, or we're shifting the meaning of words. It's a fascinating thing. And I think about the language I use and how it might impact the people that I read probably more than the average person. But the reason I wrote about this word in particular is because I think more people should think about it.
Do you have thoughts for people who maybe would like to be more open to cuisines from other places that they're not familiar with, but really find it daunting?
Sure. Yeah. I think if they are interested in trying something completely new to them, I would encourage them to pick up a cookbook or search for recipes for that online. They may not want to cook it, but it might help them to know what's in it or how it's made. Certainly they can watch videos of how it's made online. That might be a lot of fun. And that might sort of trigger some curiosity and make them perhaps seek out that food from a restaurant near them, or maybe when they're traveling, they might try something new. I think it's perfectly fine to say you've never had something. There are so many foods I've never had myself, but I can't wait to try. And I think that's just an exciting part of life. I hope other people might enjoy that too.
Daniela Galarza is a staff writer for the food section of the Washington Post. She writes its Eat Voraciously newsletter, and she recently published an essay on the Post titled Stop Calling Food Exotic. Daniela, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I really appreciate it.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. And you can subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get podcasts just by searching for KERA Think or listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.